Chapter 15 Zeost. From high orbit, the world of Zeost didn't look like a place of evil. It was a typical blue-green world, a good mix of landmass and open water, ice at the poles, white cloud formations everywhere, including the characteristic spiral of a hurricane over one of the oceans. The landmasses at the equators seemed to be almost entirely green, graduating to green-white up through the temperate zones, and turning to pure white soon after, giving the world large polar ice caps. There was no hint of desert or any terrain other than forest and tundra. It was, in fact, a beautiful place, if one looked only with one's eyes. But Ben had other senses, and through the Force he could feel something else, something malevolent about the planet. It seemed to be staring at him, as if it were a mottled eye belonging to a hideous, hate-filled face he couldn't quite make out. Ben stared at Zeost, and Zeost stared at Ben. Ben gulped. "Shaker, do you pick up any thruster trails?" Ben asked. He didn't really expect much help there. Thruster emission trails dissipated rapidly, and since a planet's vehicle and vessel traffic was heavy, all the trails tended to blur into one another. The astromech tweedled an affirmative noise, and lines of text popped up on one of the Y-Wing's cockpit displays. Heavy orbital trail indicates one or more vehicles in specific orbit for considerable time. Vehicles left orbit approximately 8 standard hours ago and made planetary descent. The cockpit sensor display switched from a live sensor feed to a diagram of the planet's surface, with dotted lines showing the abandoned orbit and the descent path. Ben felt a wash of relief. Of course, Zeost was a dead world, in terms of planetary civilization. Few vehicles ever arrived here, and thruster trails would be distinct for a longer time. That changed the prospect of finding a single vehicle in an area the size of a planetary surface from crazy to possible. He switched the R2 unit's data over to his navigation computer and plotted his own descent. From an altitude of a few kilometers, traveling slowly enough that the Y-Wing would neither cause sonic booms nor pull contrails visible from the ground, Ben studied the vehicle that must have brought Faskus back to Zeost. It was a Corellian YT-2400 light transport, disc-shaped, like Uncle Han's venerable Millennium Falcon, but with its cockpit at the end of a starboard side outrigger-style projection. At least it had once been a YT-2400. Now it was a scorched heap of buckled durasteel, blackened in numerous places by fire. Smoke still curled up into the sky from spots where the hull had ruptured. The cockpit and its access tube had separated from the transport's main body and had rolled, or been hurled, down a gentle incline, putting them 20 meters from the main hull. A light snowfall drifted down across the two main portions of the destroyed craft. Had it crash-landed? Ben increased the magnification on his visual display and shook his head. No. The scorch patterns on portions of the hull showed clear sign of turbolaser strafing. The transport had been fired upon multiple times and then had burned. Ben quickly switched back to primary sensors, but there was no sign of other air traffic in this area. The attacker was long gone. Ben spiraled down to a landing in the same clearing Faskus had chosen. He set the Y-Wing down well clear of the burned wreckage, then investigated on foot. Portions of the transport were cool enough to approach, and he was even able to enter one or two places where hatches had been blown off or the hull had gapped open wide enough to admit him. There was nothing within but lingering smoke and the smell of burned plastics and pseudo-leathers. Seeking more clues, he opened himself up to the Force and shivered. The sensation of being stared at was stronger here than it had been in orbit. He tried to set that sensation aside, to feel around and beyond it, and he could detect no hint of death. He didn't think the pilot had died in the transport. Where was he then? Ben wasn't an accomplished tracker. He didn't think he could follow a target, particularly one who had recently been fired upon and was probably cautious and deceptive, through heavy forest. And then he felt it, just at the periphery of his force senses, a little hint of wicked glee, just as he'd felt it at the display case on Drua. That glee remained steady, if distant, as he returned to his Y-wing. "Shaker, I'm going extravehicular for a while. Maybe days," he told the astromech. Shaker offered him a musical interrogative. Ben didn't need to pull out his datapad and read the transmitted text to understand. "What do you want me to do?" He thought about it. On this hostile world, an R2 unit's sensors, tools, and other capabilities could be very useful, assuming the little droid didn't become stuck in a bog or something. But Ben didn't have the winch needed to remove Shaker from his housing on the Y-wing. Some astromechs had modifications that would let them climb free and make a safe descent, but Shaker seemed to be a stock model, with no mods of any consequence. Still, Ben did have the Force available to him. He just wasn't sure he could manage a precise feat of telekinesis with something as heavy as an R2 unit. "Hold on a moment, little guy." Ben closed his eyes and concentrated. Through the Force, he could feel the looming mass of the Y-wing, even trace its contours. And there was Shaker, too. But he couldn't separate the droid in his mind from the starfighter. He didn't want to pick up the whole starfighter. Didn't even want to try. Then Shaker made a noise of curiosity, and suddenly the droid was distinct from the starfighter, its own lines clearly defined. Ben grinned and focused on the astromech. He gently pulled upward, as if trying to extract a plug from an engine. The plug proved to be stubborn, so he pulled harder. Shaker's sudden squawk of alarm almost broke Ben's concentration, but he frowned and kept at it, and could sense the astromech rising into the air and floating free of the Y-wing. Ben gestured laterally, and Shaker drifted to one side. Carefully, Ben brought the droid down to the ground and opened his eyes. Swaying a little, tired from his effort, he said, "I guess you're coming with me." The droid chirped, its tones suggesting relief. Heading westward, the direction in which Ben felt the distant glee, they plunged into the forest of Zeost. It was a cold day. Though Ben had felt comfortable out in the clearing in the cloud-muted sunlight, here the forest canopy cut off most of the sunlight, and Ben felt a chill. The massive, dark, twisting tree trunks, looking like pain-racked bodies flash-frozen and preserved in their agonies, added to his unease. He pulled his Jedi cloak from his backpack and donned it, grateful for both its warmth and the symbolic protection it offered. There were no trails through this forest, just dense undergrowth. Shaker's limitations in the environment, the droid could move briskly on its wheels on flat, hard surfaces, but had to waddle slowly on legs on uneven terrain, kept their progress slow. But in the first hour of travel, Ben did not feel the glee he was pursuing become more distant. If anything, he and Shaker seemed to be closing very slowly on his quarry. Then he heard sounds from the direction they'd come. The sounds were far away, muffled by distance and the oppressive forest, but Ben thought he recognized the scream of ion engines, the thoom of laser fire. Shaker began tweedling a complicated message. With a sinking feeling, Ben pulled out his data pad and opened it. A series of diagnostic reports scrolled by on the screen too fast to read, but then the message scrolled to a stop. The last line read, Y-wing diagnostic summary. Assessed damage precludes functioning. Communications ended. Probability 84% that Y-wing has been totally destroyed. Ben sank down to sit on the powdery snow cover on the forest floor. Faskus's enemies had come back and destroyed his transportation. The only way he knew to get back off-world. The files had suggested that no one was sure of any sentient beings still left on Zeost. There might not be anyone to help him get off-world. Ever. And no one who cared about him knew he was here. He was going to die alone on Zeost. He forced himself to stiffen up. Whether he died or not, he had a mission to finish. And once it was done, he had a second mission, a personal one, to punish the people who had tried to exile him on this lonely world. Coruscant, Jedi Temple, Council Chamber. They met in their circle of chairs, elegant stone seats, far short of thrones in lavishness, and not comfortable enough to encourage meetings that lasted for hours. The others, Mara, Corrin, Kyle Katarn, Silgal, Kip Duran, waited for Luke to sit, a tradition they'd informally adopted, and which he wished, just a bit, that they'd abandon. When all were seated, Luke said, Silgal, I'd appreciate it if you'd take the role of Terris Chi for this gathering. The Mon Cal Jedi Master blinked at him. Her protruding eyes made the action more impressive than it would be from a human.
I'm sorry, Grandmaster. Take the role of what?
Kip made a tiny noise. It could have been a noncommittal grunt. Luke glanced over to see that Kip's face was locked up with the effort not to laugh. Luke continued. Terris Chi, a tradition we haven't observed recently. You find a challenge for any idea or proposition you think isn't being adequately tested.
Ah, Silgal said. Yes, of course.
Kip twitched just once, a final suppression of laughter, and then relaxed. We have several items to consider, Luke said, in no particular order. Though we have no restrictions on how many Jedi Masters there should be, the war has clearly taken up additional time from each master, and the worsening of the war will probably take still more. This means the teaching will suffer. I propose, then, that we consider whether any senior Jedi Knights are suitable for advancement. We don't need to debate candidates today, but you should all prepare lists of those you think are suitable. Most of the Masters present nodded, all but Silgal, who considered the question, her bulbous eyes elevated to different levels, but offered no objection. Second, Luke continued, as many of you know, Ben is missing. He may have run away to reach Jason. He may have left on some personal mission to prove himself. He may... It took him a moment to force the words out. He may have been taken. Evidence Mara and I have uncovered suggests that he may have injured a woman who later died from her injuries, and that the woman's mother was Lumia. That drew some murmurs from Kyle, Corrin, and Kip. Silgal was quick to ask, Was this reason for Lumia's attack on Master Lobi? Luke nodded. Presumably. Lobi was shadowing Ben. If Lumia did something related to Ben, spoke with him, planted a tracer on him, and so forth, she would want to eliminate witnesses.
So, Silgal said, this isn't just a case of two masters demonstrating excessive attachment to an apprentice. The situation could result in the deaths of more Jedi.
Well done, Luke thought. Already a salvo launched at an accurately identified problem.
Correct. But I must ask, she continued, whether you and the other Master Skywalker are dispassionate enough about Ben to make good decisions on this issue.
Mara leaned forward as if to offer an angry reply. Luke glanced at her, and through their force bond, reached out with a touch of caution. Mara retained her pose, but did not speak. Luke answered, I think so. In any case, Mara and I have very little to go on in terms of Ben's disappearance. As of this morning, I have been unable to find Ben in the Force, which could mean that he has learned to conceal himself, that he's in a place like Dagobah where the Force characteristics of his surroundings mask his presence, or, he didn't finish that painful thought. But to be sure, I call upon the Masters to speak up if ever you think we're behaving inappropriately. I'll be the first to admit that we need to rely on your more objective judgment on this matter.
And other matters of attachment, if I may, Silgal continued. Master Horn, the issues with your family are resolved?
Corrin nodded.
All Jedi except those helping the Alliance Armed Forces in intelligence gathering are off Corellia, as is my wife. Though she may divorce me, since I left without kissing her goodbye.
Silgal did not offer the statement that had predicated her questions. Jedi should abandon attachment. It had been a basic tenet of Jedi philosophy in the Old Republic era and earlier times. Luke had, as an experiment across the years, relaxed it, describing to his students its role in Jedi history, but not insisting that it be observed by the modern Jedi generations. Having himself chosen a life with a wife and child, he could hardly rule that out for others, and these days many were formally married and often raised their own children, with varying degrees of proper Jedi detachment. He had to admit that in such cases, even in his own, true detachment could at times be nearly impossible. Silgal was unlikely to offer that criticism, because she had never indicated that she believed in the absolute merit of the old tradition. But she was obviously taking her role as Terris Chi very seriously. Also on my agenda, Luke said, an update on Leia. You've all been patient and forward-looking in allowing her to remain with Han, and I continue to think this serves both the interests of the Jedi Order and the Galactic Alliance in allowing us to keep an eye on other perspectives and on facts not otherwise available to us. Mara and I did see her during our visit to Corellian space. I wanted to put forth the idea that we continue to do so, and offer her no censure for apparently being opposed to Alliance goals, even when the Alliance continues to insist on punitive measures. This time it was Kyle Katarn who brought up the likelihood of argument. Lightly bearded, a few years older than Luke, he actually looked a touch younger because he had not picked up as impressive a collection of facial scars.
You're certain that your attachment to your sister doesn't influence the way you're handling the issue?
Luke nodded. Unlike the situation with my son, I'm at ease with this issue, comfortable with all my decisions.
The Galactic Alliance has valid points on this matter,
Katarn said.
Not necessarily a Durasteel-clad case, but valid points.
They're not asking us to bring her to justice in chains. But if the Jedi Order supports the Alliance, and a Jedi Knight is actively supporting the enemy, their contention is that the Jedi Knight in question should be expelled from the Order.
Maybe we should, Mara said, once a fair trial has proven that she has aided the enemy. It hasn't been proven yet. Her presence with Han at several events has been noted, yes, but not even Tenel Ka, the intended victim of their alleged assassination attempt, believes them to be guilty of it.
And, Kip added, there's the question of whether they can get a fair trial in the current environment.
Katarn waved their comments away.
Considering it dispassionately, he said, what would it change if Leia Solo were expelled from the Order? She'd continue to stay with Han, continue to provide you with crucial information. She wouldn't stop being your sister, after all, and we could readmit her once the trial ruled for her innocence.
Thereby making the Alliance government happy, Luke said. But would it be right, Master Katarn? Expelling her for taking the initiative and investigating things she sees that no one else does? Which one of us hasn't done that? No one raised a hand, and he continued, are you really advocating that? Or are you assuming Silgal's role as honored debate opponent for a moment? Katarn smiled, flashing white teeth.
Does it matter? The proposal has merit, or lacks merit on its own, regardless of whether I believe in it.
He's right, Silgal said. We need to analyze the proposal on its own merit, and the Grand Master's response to it likewise.
Well, here's my response, Luke said. If we strip Leia of her Jedi knighthood because of allegations, and in so doing prevent the Alliance from visiting penalties on us, penalties that could reduce our effectiveness, then we'd be doing a small wrong to prevent a potential larger wrong. But it's not the mission of the Jedi Order to do evil. Our job is to identify things that are wrong and get in their way, even when it costs us our resources, our happiness, and our lives. That's what I propose we do here. Katarn nodded as if pleased with the answer. He turned to Corrin.
Master Horn, I notice you haven't been saying much.
Corrin had been sitting with his brow furrowed for most of the discussion. Now he nodded.
I was under the impression that the Terrace Chi was some sort of bug on Kessel. Booster said they tasted like muck dripping from a badly maintained engine.
Mara gave Corrin a scowl that all but said, "Not now, you idiot." Kip lowered his face into his palm.
"Talk about straying from the topic," he said.
Corrin relaxed, his expression becoming more neutral.
"All right, back on topic. We've all been talking about dispassionate analysis in this argument. Now, I approve of dispassionate analysis. That's how criminals get caught and convicted. But we're also Jedi, and encouraged to trust our feelings. I just spent several days in Leia's company, and friend or not, I came away convinced that she wasn't supporting Corellia, any more than she's supporting the Alliance. She wants to find out the truth behind the war, the truth behind her son's questionable decisions, which also reflect badly on the Order, despite the fact their government approved, I might add. She's trying to identify the wrong and to maneuver herself in front of it. I don't think that we should discourage her from that, even by a reprimand some of us consider irrelevant. I think we should trust our feelings."
They were all silent for a moment, and Luke wanted to cheer. Finally, Katarn said,
I'm probably the master present, who has the fewest connections of family or long-term friendship with Lea Solo. And I formally recommend that we take no action against her for the time being.
The others agreed. That's my agenda, Luke said. Anyone else?
I have something, Silgal said. The war, limited as it has been so far, has increased the rate of Jedi injury, and, sadly, death. We have had no trouble dealing with the increase with our available resources, but now the war is spreading.
Zeost. Ben spent a cold night. In the first part of the night, he found a low hollow spot where the wind couldn't reach him. He rolled up tight in his Jedi robe and fell almost instantly asleep. Then, 2 hours later, he woke up, so cold that it was his own body shaking that had jarred him from sleep. He was also blind, or so he thought, unable to see Shaker less than a meter away. But when his cold, stiffened hand was able to extract a glow rod from his pocket and ignite it, he realized that he was surrounded by fog. Together, he and Shaker clambered their way out of the hollow, and he found that the temperature rose by several degrees as they ascended the slope. Toward the top, he used his lightsaber to cut dead branches from some of the trees. With them and leaves, he built a fire, igniting it with his lightsaber. After a few minutes of warming himself, he made a sort of nest out of snow and more leaves. Only then did he allow himself to fall asleep again. The cold awoke him several times during the night, and once distant screams, like a primate being tortured, jarred him from his rest. Each time he was able to doze off again, though it was to formless dreams in which dark shapes crawled close to his sleeping body and whispered into his ear in a language he did not know. By morning he was slightly more rested, but he would have traded a month's service to a hot refresher cleaning firm in exchange for a tent and a portable heater. Once the sun was up high enough to provide some sparse heat to his surroundings, he and Shaker set out again. He could still feel the distant glee. At mid-morning, he ran out of the food he had brought himself on Drua.
"I don't suppose you have anything stored in an inner compartment?" he asked Shaker.
The droid responded with a low, negative trill.
"Know anything about hunting?"
Shaker gave him the same answer.
"I mean, I'm not asking you to hunt. I was just wondering if you had any texts on hunting, something I could read, to learn how."
Shaker's answer this time was a more excited series of beeps, but the R2 unit lurched forward, waddling faster. They were now at the edge of a large, snow-filled clearing, and Shaker moved into that open space. Following, Ben saw the reason for the astromech's agitation. In the distance, beyond the next verge of trees, a plume of smoke rose into the sky. Someone had built a fire, and that beacon was in exactly the same direction as the sense of glee Ben sought. An hour later, they were at the edge of another clearing, looking at a camp. There was a tent, improvised from several bright red emergency blankets and yellow cord. There was a fire, as paltry as Ben's own from the previous night. There was an enormous backpack, rigged from an oversized carry sack, a few Durasteel spars, doubtless salvaged from the downed YT-2400, and more yellow cord. And there was a man. Leaving Shaker behind, Ben crept forward, keeping low behind snow mounds. When he was close enough to get a good look at the man, he felt a sense of disappointment. Faskus of Zeost didn't look much like a protector of Sith artifacts. He was a pale-skinned human with a chin that was just two steps short of being adequate, and a thick, curling black mustache that only emphasized his chin's inadequacy. He wore gray garments that were the height of anonymity. He moved slowly, adding branches to his fire, and talked to himself, words that Ben could not hear. And the first time he turned in Ben's direction, to add another handful of sticks to the fire, Ben could see that he wore the amulet of Kalara on its chain around his neck. Ben froze. If Faskus knew he was here, the man could vanish from his perceptions, could track him down and kill him with little effort. Ben had to obtain the amulet without alerting Faskus, and that meant waiting for an opportunity. No, Ben was hungry now, and would only get hungrier, and colder. Exercise being counterproductive when an agent was trying to remain undetected. If he waited, he would either become so weak and stiff that he could not complete his mission, or he would freeze to death. So the situation meant that he would have to attack, and attack soon, and attack without mercy. Anyone who could steal the amulet and wield its power had to be formidable. When Faskus turned his back again, still mumbling to himself, Ben crept closer. A depression in the terrain allowed him to approach within 10 meters of the tent. He could hear some of Faskus's words.
"Worry at all. Got to be shelter. Not as bad as it looks."
Ben rose up to peek over the edge of the depression. Faskus had his back to him again. Ben sprang forward, shoving himself through the force, giving his leap extra distance, extra altitude. In the middle of his arc, he brought up his lightsaber. As he began his descent, he ignited it. The sound alerted Faskus, who began to turn. And in the final quarter second before impact, Ben saw beyond Faskus, sitting on blankets at the front of the tent, staring up at him with wondering eyes, a little girl. He was going to cut off the man's head in front of this little girl. Ben landed foot first, kicking Faskus back across the girl. Landing astride the man, he heard Faskus's grunt of pain, heard the girl's muffled shriek. Ben's lightsaber cut into the tent's top blanket, setting the edges afire. He shut the weapon off. Then he got his free hand on the amulet and yanked. The chain didn't give way, and neither did Faskus's neck. Ben swore and yanked up, drawing the chain free of its wearer. Only then did he retreat, scrambling backward from the tent mouth, and dropped the amulet into his pouch. The little girl squeezed herself out from beneath Faskus's legs and looked around wild-eyed. She had dark hair, cut short, and blue eyes. She might have been 6 standard years old, and she wore a garment that was a child's copy of an orange X-wing jumpsuit. When she caught sight of Ben, she shrieked again. She reached down, and her hand came up with a few twigs and leaves, which she hurled at Ben. One stick flew as far as his foot. The rest of the debris fell well short. "Shut up," Ben said. The girl hurled herself on Faskus.
"Daddy, wake up! Daddy!"
"Daddy?" Ben rose and moved forward again. The girl turned and grabbed more debris from the tent interior to hurl at Ben. This time it was a Duralumin cooking pan. He batted it to one side, not breaking stride, and entered the tent.
"Stop that!"
"Don't hurt Daddy!"
She grabbed for something else. A blaster. Ben, suddenly alarmed again, tugged at it through the force, and it flew to its hand. It was light. Too light. He looked it over, It was a child's toy, a miniature copy of the classic DL-44 blaster pistol, like the one his Uncle Han usually carried. Ben tossed it out through the opening. "Stop throwing things! I mean it!" The girl froze, her hand up with a fork in it. Keeping an eye on her when he could, Ben looked at Faskus. The man was unconscious. Odd, since Ben didn't think he'd hit him that hard. But that would help. Ben returned his lightsaber to his belt, then patted Faskus down. The blaster in Faskus's belt holster was real. So were the smaller ones in his boot and in the small holster under his right sleeve. So was the vibroblade in the sheath in his left sleeve. Ben appropriated all the weapons, then looked around. There was a coil of yellow cord in one corner of the tent. Ben snatched it up. Then he rolled Faskus over, discovering and appropriating another blaster in a holster at the base of his spine, and got to work tying his hands. The fork hit him in the cheek, stuck for a moment, then fell free.
"You're hurting him!"
Ben rubbed his cheek. His fingers came away with a smear of blood on them. "No, I'm not. I'm just tying him up."
"He's already hurt. You're making it worse."
Ben finished with Faskus's hands and got to work on the man's feet.
"Where?"
"His stomach."
Ben rolled Faskus over again and pulled up the man's gray tunic. He whistled. An improvised bandage, thick layers of shirt cloth held on by bindings made from torn cloth strips, covered the lower left portion of Faskus's stomach. It was soaked with blood. Carefully, Ben untied the strips and lifted the bandage free. A look at the blood-washed skin beneath showed him that Faskus had suffered a penetrating wound at least 7 centimeters long. More blood welled from it as the bandage came away. Faskus groaned, but did not wake up. Ben replaced and retied the cloth. He'd received training in first aid from both his Jedi teachers and the guard, but more than first aid was called for here. He put his hands on Faskus's chest and brow and sought what knowledge and feelings he could through the Force. He didn't know much about Force healing, but Master Selgal and his father had taught him a few things, bare necessities. Faskus was not strong in the Force, not strongly here. He was like a flickering candle compared with his daughter. There was turbulence from the wound. As Ben peered deeper, he sensed blood flowing where it should not. He sensed life ebbing. He didn't know much about stomach wounds. Other Jedi had told him they sometimes didn't bleed much, but that they usually hurt a lot. Faskus should be dead now, and it was clear that only willpower and a desire to protect his daughter were keeping him alive, and even they wouldn't be enough for long. Ben hesitated, wondering how to tell the girl. "What's your name?" he asked.
"Kiara. Are you going to make him better?"
"I can't." Faskus's eyes opened. They were glassy. He tried to roll to one side and failed. His vision cleared a bit, and he looked at Ben.
"Who are you?" he asked.
"Ben Skywalker, Galactic Alliance Guard."
"Any relation to Luke Skywalker?"
"I'm his son."
"Good."
Faskus lay back and closed his eyes for a moment. Ben thought the man might die then and there, but this was only a gesture of relief, and Faskus opened his eyes to look at his daughter.
"Guardsman Skywalker, we'll take care of you from now on."
"No, Daddy!"
Kiara hurled herself onto her father's chest.
"He hurt you!"
"He just knocked me down. I was already hurt. The starfighter hurt me."
uncomfortable with the exchange, with what was coming, Ben interrupted.
Why did you steal the amulet of Kalara?
Faskus looked at him, confused.
I didn't.
Yes, you did. From an office building on Drua.
Drua is where they gave it to me, yes. That's where I live and work.
I thought you were from Zeost.
Faskus shook his head.
Not an energetic move. I'm from Almania. I'm a courier.
Who gave the amulet to you?
A Bothan, named Dure. He told me to bring it here, to land at specific coordinates, and carry the amulet to a nearby cave. To come alone.
He laughed, one short bark that ended in a gasp of pain.
I'm sorry, Kiara. I wish I had. I'm so sorry.
And you were strafed? Ben asked. Faskus nodded.
I was partway to the cave when I heard the engine roar. I ran back to the Blacktooth. They were firing on it. A TIE fighter. Kiara was still inside. I had to reach her.
Ben didn't need to ask anything more. The rest of the story was clear to him. Faskus had gotten his daughter clear of the transport, but some calamity, an explosion perhaps, had sent a shard of Durasteel into his guts and killed him. Slowly.
Please.
His voice was weak, wavering.
Untie my hands.
So I can hold her.
Ben thought it over, then nodded. Using Faskus's own vibroblade, he cut the bonds on the man's hands. Then, while Kiara sobbed and Faskus spoke soothingly to her in ever quieter tones, Ben began to break down the man's camp and inventory his goods. And to think. I have the amulet, and it can't be used against me. This stage of his mission was accomplished. Ben could check it off his list. Now he needed to find a way to get off planet, or at least to send a signal to Jason. If Faskus, or whatever his real name might be, didn't steal the amulet, who did? Dure, whoever he was. And Dure had framed Faskus by leaving the note behind. But why would Dure give Faskus the real amulet to bury in a cave? This had to be the real thing. Up close it reeked of dark side energy and the creepy happiness that had allowed Ben to follow it. Something did not add up. Ben counted 6 oversized blankets, one of them slightly damaged by his lightsaber, several wooden poles being used as tent poles, 4 durasteel spikes anchoring the tent to the ground, 3 blasters, and a vibroblade, each one with extra power packs, food rations, possibly as much as a week's worth, a quantity of cord, the backpack, the contents of Faskus's pouch, including a datapad, numerous cred coins, cred cards, data cards, and identicards, and the man's clothes, if he wanted them. But he didn't. He carefully broke down the tent, exposing the girl and her father to the first snowfall of the day, and folded all the blankets except the ones constituting the floor, on which Faskus and Kiara still lay. Faskus's eyes were still open, but he no longer spoke, and Ben could not feel him through the Force. The astromech came waddling down from its position of concealment as Ben began dividing all his new goods between his own pack and the larger backpack Faskus had made.
"Good news, Shaker," Ben said. "Several power packs. If you have adapters, we can keep you going for a long time."
But Shaker's response didn't sound happy. The droid kept its optics trained on Kiara and Faskus, trilling a discordant note.
Yeah, Ben said. It's sad.
Even sadder was what he'd have to do in a minute. But his duty was clear. He had to get the amulet to Jason, and that meant not taking chances with his resources. He thought about asking Kiara to move so he could claim the final two blankets, but decided that such a request was unnecessary. Four blankets would be enough for just him. He spent a few minutes using more cord to tie the big backpack to Shaker's dome, and then he began walking. He didn't hear Shaker following. He turned to see the R2 still in place. Its optic sensor glided back and forth, staring first at him, then at Kiara.
Come on, Shaker.
The astromech began waddling in his direction. Ben imagined that he could sense reluctance in its pace, but he pushed the thought away. Shaker had never met these people before, and therefore it could not care about them.
Hey!
Kiara sat up. Snow was accumulating in her hair, and tears were freezing to her cheeks.
You can't go. Daddy said you were going to take care of us.
I'm sorry, Ben said, but I didn't say I would.
You can't leave him. The animals will eat him.
I'm sorry.
Turning his back on the girl a second time took an act of will, but recognition of his duty gave him the strength to do it. He began walking again, slowly, and Shaker followed. The droid trilled a long and complicated communication. Ben opened his datapad, and it had received Shaker's message. What is our destination?
I had a look at Faskus's datapad.
Ben tapped his pouch to reassure himself that the pad was still there.
There's information on Zeost that I don't have, like the coordinates where he was supposed to set down, the cave where he was supposed to leave the amulet. I guess he abandoned that part of the plan after he got hurt, and a lot of locations marked ruins. I bet that wherever there are ruins, there's stuff to find. Maybe even people. Maybe even the base that TIE fighter is from. We're headed for the nearest ruin site. I bet Faskus was too.
Why are you leaving the girl behind? That caused Ben's stomach to knot up again.
Because if she's with us, we'll go through our resources faster, like our food, and we might not get to where we need to go. Our mission is more important than her life.
Is the mission more important than your life, too? Ben thought about it for 50 meters of travel.
Yes.
Then tell me your mission, so that if you falter, I can abandon you and complete it. Ben turned and round-kicked the astromech in its dome. Shaker squawked and fell over. But the bindings Ben had used to lash the big backpack in place did not loosen.
Shut up, you walking hot plate! If you didn't have a few useful systems to go along with that malfunctioning droid brain of yours, I'd leave you too!
Shaker didn't offer a response. It didn't try to right itself. Ben forced himself to calm down. He'd wait until he was sure he didn't need the astromech anymore. Then he'd crush it in a vise or throw it out an upper-story viewport. No, that made no sense. It was valuable property. He could sell it for passage to another planet, if he could find someone willing to take him. With a sigh, he righted the astromech, then continued walking. An hour later, as they crossed a lightly forested ridgeline, Ben's datapad beeped. But Shaker hadn't made any noise indicating he was trying to communicate. Ben stopped and opened his datapad. images of his parents swam into focus on its diminutive screen. They were both smiling.
"Ben," Mara said, "in case you hadn't noticed, you're 14.
"Congratulations on another birthday," Luke said. "So whatever torture your teachers, including me, had in store for you today, forget it. Report to me for some birthday credits, and the rest of the day is yours to enjoy."
Their images faded to blackness. Shaker came up behind Ben and waited with a droid's patience. Oddly, Ben felt as though there were nothing inside him, as if he had suddenly become a Ben-shaped balloon filled with gas. Gas could not think, and neither could he, for a long moment. They had to have recorded this shortly before he started this mission.
"Hi, Mom," he said. "Hi, Dad. For my 14th birthday, I killed a little girl."
He sat down, his lower back resting against the astromech. He leaned forward, wrapping his arms around his knees. And he began to cry. Kiara stabbed at the ground with the knife. It was an eating utensil, not a vibroblade, and when it hit the ground it made a ringing noise. Sometimes it scraped away a little of the ice-hard soil. Sometimes it didn't. After more than an hour of digging, punctuated by fits of sobbing, she had dug a hole a little larger than her hand. But she'd keep digging. Her father was dead, and she had to put him in the ground so the animals wouldn't come and eat him. Through the snowfall she could see that there were booted feet in front of her. She looked up into the face of Ben Skywalker. The waddling astromech was entering the clearing from the far edge. Ben didn't say anything for a few moments. Then he took a look around.
"I think," he said, "we need to wrap him in one of the blankets, then pile rocks on top of him. That will keep the animals away."
"They won't eat him?"
"They won't eat him. I'll wrap him up and find the rocks. You put the other blanket around you and go sit with Shaker."
Kiara did as she was told. Her tears didn't stop flowing, but now she knew her father would be safe under the rocks.